Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the first diagnosis of Ebola in the U.S. befalling a patient who was recently in Liberia and was sent home by a Dallas hospital, only to return by ambulance 2 days later. Kevin Addison, the co-director of the Health Law Program at Boston University and a founding member of the CDC's Working Group on Antimicrobial Resistance, joins us to discuss how this case will be contained, even if the panic about Ebola in the U.S. might not, particularly with politicians like Texas Governor Perry grandstanding about threats to school children. We will also discuss how Republican budget austerity has impacted the NIH and the CDC, with budgets today for these medical first responders much lower than they were in 2010. Then we'll examine the prospects for a deal to work with the detestable Assad regime to eliminate the even worse Islamic State, who just beheaded a number of Syrian and Kurdish prisoners, including some women fighting with the Kurdish Peshmerga. An expert on Syria and the region, Usher Kaufman, a professor of history and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame, joins us to discuss whether Turkey and Jordan could be brought on board, assuming the U.S. is open to such a deal, and what Israel's attitude might be, since they seem to have had a stable modus vivendi with the Assad regime prior to the civil war. Then finally, we will speak with Thomas Edsel, a professor of journalism at Columbia University, who has an op-ed at the New York Times, "Are Liberals Funding Hypocrites?" We will discuss his contention that by joining in the chase for dark money from anonymous billionaires to play catch-up to the Republicans, the Democrats are losing the moral high ground in getting money out of politics and, in effect, are getting their money from the same people as the Republicans, which only serve to perpetuate the oligarchic control of our politics. And joining us now is Kevin Addison, who's the co-director of the Health Law Program at Boston University and a founding member of the CDC's Working Group on Antimicrobial Resistance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kevin Addison.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And there is, of course, a patient in Dallas who has Ebola, having come in recently from Liberia. And initially, the patient went to the hospital, the Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas, and was discharged, and then came back a few days later and was diagnosed with Ebola and is now in isolation. And, of course, there was a great deal of hysteria associated with the American doctors who had contracted Ebola earlier, and they were brought back to the United States, and there were people like Donald Trump opining that they shouldn't bring people like that back into the United States and leave them to die in Africa, I assume. In this case, now that Ebola, the headline is that Ebola has arrived in America, doesn't it open us up to a possibility of a unnecessary national hysteria?
Well, I have to say that every day we have, you know, more than 100 Americans who die of antibiotic resistance. You know, we have 37,000 people a year identified by the CDC who die from various bacterial diseases. So while it's a serious threat that one patient in Dallas has a virus from Ebola, there are many potential pathogens out there that we ignore or don't give enough attention to every day. So it's a serious threat, but it needs to be placed in the context of everything else that our healthcare system faces.
And the governor of Texas is having a press conference down at the hospital in Dallas and talking about a bunch of school children being infected. I mean, what do we know? That doesn't sound like it's particularly helpful to panic people. I imagine there are people on the ground that are doing the research into who this patient, Thomas Eric Duncan, contacted from the time that he arrived in the United States to the present. Isn't that the methodology? Or tell us what the methodology is in terms of tracking down those who possibly have been infected.
So with all respect to Governor Perry, the folks I would listen to right now are public health officials who are usually, you know, not politicians and very serious and don't like to overstate issues and they want to speak as clearly as possible. So public health, you know, what the CDC and the Texas Department of Public Health would do is to try to track down every person that an infected person has had contact with. They call this contact tracing. And they will very thoroughly and very quickly deploy a lot of people to try to track back everyone who could possibly have been infected by him. And if there's other infections, which there may well be, you know, we don't know, they'll do the same thing for those folks. And what that does is it interrupts as quickly as possible transmission. So what's happening in West Africa, very different situation. You know, it's been difficult for contact tracing to happen in those communities. In some communities, healthcare workers have been ostracized or even attacked. In Dallas, people are going to cooperate, and the CDC and the public health officials will get a good grip on this very quickly.
So as far as we know, the patient, Thomas Eric Duncan, went to the Dallas emergency room on Friday, was sent home with antibiotics, and then he returned 2 days later after his condition worsened and was admitted to the Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital. And now my understanding is that they've gone back with his family members. There is a report that somebody else appears to have developed Ebola, but they've also obviously talking to the ambulance drivers. Apparently there's between 12 and 18 people being monitored because of exposure. I don't understand the connection that Governor Perry's talking about with a handful of school children. Do we know whether this patient was active when he got back? Or how would he come into contact with school children?
Well, there's no way for me to know. These are the sort of questions that I think politicians or 24-hour cable news would love to speculate on, you know, for hours, and we need to stick to the facts. One fact I think is really interesting here is that he has a virus. He was sent home with an antibiotic, which is, of course, what happens to millions of Americans every year, taking an antibiotic in a situation in which there's no established proof of it. We really lack a diagnostic that would tell a doctor at the point of care, hey, this is exactly what this patient has. You know, not just Ebola, but all sorts of illnesses. It would be nice to know exactly what they had immediately. And so part of what was going on here is we lacked a diagnostic to identify what the patient had and was sent home with an inappropriate therapy. You know, antibiotic does not work against a virus. You know, it doesn't matter what sort of virus, it wouldn't have worked. It would be nice to know what else the hospital was told, you know, the emergency room. So, you know, I haven't seen anything clearly from public health officials or from a trustworthy source on whether the hospital was told that he had just come back from West Africa. That, I think, would be interesting information.
Well, there are reports that he did say he'd come in from Liberia, and then there are other reports that the hospital admitters were given insufficient information. But my understanding is that Ebola is not contagious until actually the symptoms arrive and are manifest. Is that your understanding?
I'm not in a position to give an opinion on that. You need to talk to somebody who's a true expert on clinical Ebola.
Right.
So we've all heard reports in the media, but this is a disease we don't know a lot about yet. And I would turn that question to somebody who's a full Ebola expert.
Sure. Well, on the good news side, though, Kevin Addison, again, the co-director of the Health Law Program at Boston University and a founding member of the CDC's Working Group on Antimicrobial Resistance, the good news is that this Ebola epidemic, which the World Health Organization has described as being out of control and growing exponentially in West Africa, and about 3,000 people have died so far, and obviously many more are infected. There are reports now that indicate that there's a global effort underway to bring some kind of inoculation to the market. What's your understanding about how far along we are on this experimental drug that people could be given, I guess, to prevent the spread rather than cure it?
You're talking about ZMapp or some other?
Yeah. Apparently there's several that they're working on, but there's a concerted global effort now to come up with an antibody, you know.
So one thing to note is that, you know, right now we have more cases of Ebola, twice as many from Ebola than we've ever had in history. So this isn't just an epidemic. This is the worst outbreak ever. And there was no sense, there was no warning, there was no sense that we knew this was coming 5 years ago and failed to prepare. So it's a surprise, the actual timing of the specific timing. The second thing is that despite the fact that there's really no commercial market for such a thing. There's really not a good business plan for any company to invest in Ebola research. You know, maybe there is today, but there wasn't 5 years ago. The U.S. government and the Canadian government gave money to companies over the past decade to work on Ebola. The only reason we have anything right now that's even close to being able to be used in humans is because scientists have been toiling away at their labs for the past decade, funded by the U.S. government, by the European Union, and by the government of Canada, to try to develop these products. Now, they weren't ready in the sense that they hadn't been through full human trials. But I have to say, running trials for Ebola is difficult because you have to find patients with Ebola to give them the treatment. And, you know, it's sort of a difficult problem. You have to wait for an outbreak before you can test the product. It's not something like heart disease that you always have a population of people willing to try. So, you know, the response, certainly it would be excellent if we had had, you know, hundreds of thousands of doses of a cure ready to go. But people need to recognize that scientists were working on this under the radar, you know, quietly for many years to try to be ready for such a moment as this. And it came a little more quickly and a lot more aggressively than anyone thought. But, you know, there's a reason why these budgets for things like medical research are important.
Well, just to clarify the point earlier about when Ebola becomes contagious, this patient traveled from Liberia's capital, Monrovia, to Brussels and then on to Dallas. But according to Tom Frieden, the head of the CDC, Ebola doesn't spread before someone gets sick, and he didn't get sick until 4 days after he got off the plane. So I guess that answers that question.
Yeah, that would be good news for Brussels and every passenger on those airplanes.
So you mentioned, though, working on immunizations and cures for Ebola, but my understanding is that in terms of budgets for both the CDC and the NIH, currently the CDC's annual budget is, in fact, nearly $600 million lower than it was in 2010. In 2010, it was $6.467 billion, and in 2013, after sequestration took effect, it was cut down to $5.432 billion. So it looks as though research and prevention and efforts to deal with this as is happening now, which it sounds like when you have to contain these outbreaks, it could be very expensive. And clearly you need a lot of mobility, you know, a ready reaction force almost akin to the military. Give us a picture of the overall budget situation. It sounds like Ebola has become a victim of budget cutting and austerity.
Well, I would say that public health preparedness in general has been a victim of budget austerity. Things that are non-defense discretionary spending in the U.S. have suffered, including basic medical research, all sorts of other federal and state programs, and certainly things like the Centers for Disease Control, which I view, you know, preventing a disease is a lot more cost-effective than trying to track people and treat them and cure them. So that's just an unfortunate reality of where our political budget process has been at the federal government for the past 5 or 6 years. Not only CDC funding is down, but National Institutes of Health, their research funding in general, is inflation-adjusted, is down from 2009 as well. Not specifically, I haven't seen the figures specifically for research on Ebola, but across the map. And we should be grateful that some of that money still got through to fund the research projects that are now bearing fruit with potential treatments like ZMapp.
Well, apparently there's quite a Liberian diaspora in North Dallas, 10,000 all told. And there appears to be a potential for a sort of hysteria, and perhaps Governor Perry's remarks aren't being particularly helpful in that regard. What's your understanding of how the public can be educated not to overreact and stigmatize, for example, a community, as is the potential with the Liberians?
So I think the director of the CDC, you know, Frieden, and he's had very, very science-based, very fact-based you know, conferences, teleconferences with the press. And certainly that sort of information is more trustworthy, I think, than just what people have heard on on programs like this one. You know, I would direct people to the real experts on this, which would be the CDC. But something the public can do is that many of the federal agencies that are dealing with this crisis right now will have to go back to Congress and either ask permission to shift money from one thing to another to this Ebola epidemic, or better yet, to ask for, you know, additional money to fund their efforts. The CDC has quite a number of people in Africa, as well as, you know, now in Dallas, and various other federal agencies have scrambled. The FDA moved very quickly to advance the trials for some of these drugs and treatments. And so there's a lot of this military expense. There's a lot of things happening right now in response, with a lot of money being spent to prevent, you know, a catastrophe in West Africa. And they have to go to Congress to ask for money for that. It'll be a significant amount of money. And it'll be helpful to see if Congress is willing to pay for that, or whether they're going to force these agencies to cut other things, other important things, maybe the next disaster, in order to fund what's happening right now.
So what is going on now with these agencies whose budgets have been cut? Again, the current budget for the CDC is $600 million lower than it was in 2010. I mean, it's early in the fiscal year, so I guess they're just tapping into what they have, but that's going to cause them problems later. And
They will technically go to Congress and ask if they ask for a reallocation, if they move money from one, you know, budget line to another. But with something like this, they do just respond, and then they work with Congress to see if there's additional funds that are available. One of the difficulties right now is that election is close, and the House, I think, is unofficially ceased doing business until after the election, and revenue bills like this have to come out of the House. And so, you know, whether there can be a quick supplemental appropriation that takes care of this in a speedy fashion, that would be helpful, because there's a lot of moving parts to this response, and we can't afford to worry about, you know, whether or not it's authorized. You know, we need to do what's medically necessary right now, not just in Africa, but also in the United States. And this is not a time to be worrying about, you know, whether Congress is going to approve it. That Congress needs to move on this and make sure that there's adequate funds available for the type of emergency response we have. Then we can have a discussion about, well, maybe this area, this whole area of health preparedness, public health preparedness, you know, maybe there's a longer-term discussion on how that should be, the investments there should be, you know, more robust and better thought out long-term.
Well, given that the Congress is pretty much in recess and they're all campaigning back in their districts as the November elections fast approach, Nancy Pelosi has asked for the Congress to come back into session to do a war vote on Iraq, which is not being met with much enthusiasm. You would think, though, that this issue might be something that everybody could agree on, surely.
I wouldn't speculate on what all of Congress could agree on.
Right, right.
But,
I guess so.
But hopefully, you know, one would think that this is the sort of thing that a majority of Congress, both Republicans and Democrats, can see the importance of containing the outbreak in West Africa for its impact on global security, and also, obviously, preventing any sort of major outbreak in the United States of America. This is a tier one priority emergency response, and I would hope everyone in our government would agree.
And just in closing, the work that you've been doing is to try and bring a kind of public-private partnership together, or some kind of mechanism to re-incentivize big pharma to get involved with dealing with problems like Ebola, where there's not a great deal of profit margin and the people that tend to be affected by it are in Africa and other countries, and it's not like...
Yeah, I wouldn't say just big pharma. I mean, all sorts of companies, large and small, have fled, you know, the business of preparing new antibiotics. And so the work I've been doing is not focused on viruses like Marburg or Ebola, but on bacteria. And like I said, we have, you know, 47,000 Americans a year who are dying from resistant bacteria and from Clostridium difficile. It's a serious issue. 37,000, I misspoke. And so we need to focus on this as well, and it needs a long-term plan. We don't know when we will have a major outbreak of drug-resistant bacteria in the United States. But when it comes, that's not the time to respond. The time to respond in the research labs is a decade earlier. And fortunately, last week on Thursday, there was a series of announcements in the White House on trying to move these plans forward. But a lot of that activity has really been lost in what's happening with Ebola, which is proper to focus on, kind of the crisis in front of us. But we need to plan now and prevent the next crisis, which may not be a virus. It may well be a bacteria, and it may not come from West Africa. It may come, directly from a U.S. community. It may start here and not be the sort of thing that's just people in a different country, a different continent. It may start right at home, and we need to be prepared to prevent that and to be able to contain it if it happens.
Well, Kevin Addison, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
All right, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Kevin Addison, who's the co-director of the Health Law Program at Boston University and a founding member of the CDC's Working Group on Antimicrobial Resistance. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Asher Kaufman, who's a professor of history and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame. Prior to that, he taught at Hebrew University, Jerusalem. And from 2000 to 2004, he was a research fellow at the Harry S. Truman Research Institute for the Advancement of Peace and headed its Middle East unit. Kaufman is the author of Reviving Phoenicia, The Search for Identity in Lebanon, A History of Modern Lebanese National Identity. And his latest book is Contested Frontiers, Cartography, Sovereignty, and Conflict at the Syria-Lebanon-Israel Tri-Border Region. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asher Kaufman.
Thank you for having me, Jan.
And the Turkish Prime Minister spoke today, President Erdogan, spoke today at the opening of Parliament and said, we will fight effectively against both the Islamic State and other terrorist organizations within the region. This will always be our priority. We will also continue to prioritize our aim to remove the Syrian regime, to help protect the territorial integrity of Syria, and to encourage a constitutional parliamentary government system which embraces all of its citizens. Now, he makes that speech while Turkish soldiers are literally standing on the border watching the Islamic State slaughter Kurdish fighters right there on the border. And on Wednesday, there were, I believe, seven prisoners taken by the Islamic State, and three of them were women fighting with the Peshmerga, and they were all beheaded. So where do you think Turkey stands now? Because the president did say that he is authorizing the use of Turkish bases for strikes against the Islamic State, which might open up the big NATO base at Incirlik.
Yes, there seems to be broad support in Turkey for some kind of intervention against the Islamic State. Recent polls indicate that most Turks oppose the agenda, the political agenda of the Islamic State, and I think Erdogan is leading that move. Will he be able to achieve his goals, removing the Islamic State from, getting rid of the Islamic State, and also getting rid of the Assad regime. That's a big question mark.
Well, that's what I was interested in exploring with you, Asher Kaplan, because I spoke with Graham Fuller, former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, a long-time Arab-speaking specialist on the Middle East. And he wrote an op-ed suggesting that maybe it's time for the United States to swallow the bitter pill and make a deal with the Assad regime to get rid of the Islamic State, because at the moment, by bombing the Islamic State, who Assad certainly didn't go after with any energy, he was always, giving them a safe passage while he was pounding the so-called secular Free Syrian Army. But now that the U.S. is bombing the Islamic State, Assad's free to turn his guns on the people that the U.S. support. So the policy itself has some major contradictions, and I guess what Graham Fuller is suggesting is it's just time for a bit of reality to recognize that the policies have failed. Both the United States policy has failed, and clearly Turkey's policy has failed vis-a-vis Syria, and, to basically bite the bullet. So what's your analysis of that?
Well, I agree with him that the U.S. policies have failed. There is hardly any question about that. But supporting now the Assad regime so that Syria stabilizes, and then in this way you would be able to deal with the Islamic State, the threat of the Islamic State, that's a very crude, realist point of view, and it is very difficult for me to support it. I think that if America does that, it would lose any remaining credibility it may still have in the region. And I mean, it's one of the biggest dilemmas that we face today. I mean, the Middle East is just getting from bad to worse on a daily basis, and there are no good ideas, good options how to get out of it. One thing is, for me, is certain is that is if the United States now supports the Assad regime, indeed it would lose any credibility in the region.
Well, no, it's not at all likely. It's not even on the agenda. And certainly Samantha Power at the UN is saying the opposite.
It could happen indirectly. It doesn't have to be directly, but indirectly it could happen. And in a way, it's already happening indirectly, in the sense that the U.S. is now reaching an agreement with Iran that would create a new kind of relationship between the United States and Iran. It's already bombing the Islamic State inside Syria, and that clearly is in favor of the Assad regime. So indirectly, you see a movement towards assistance to Assad, maybe not intentional, but this is already happening.
So what's the position of the Israelis? Because they've always had pretty much a modus vivendi with the Assad regime. There's been a lot of stability on that border for decades, and prior to Bashar al-Assad, his father Hafez al-Assad, in spite of the number of wars that the U.S. and that Israel and Syria are engaged in.
Yes,
that border was pretty stable, and the Golan Heights have never been challenged. So, what do you understand that Israel's realpolitik position is vis-a-vis the Assad regime?
Well, you're right to say it. I mean, historically, the Assad regime has been remarkably stable, and the Syrian-Israeli border along the Golan Heights was the quietest, the safest since 1974. And during the early days of the civil war, Israeli politicians wished good luck to all sides, cynically saying that they wish good luck to both sides. Now I think it becomes very clear that Assad is actually maybe good for Israel, or at least was good for Israel, and that we should not be, Israel should not be looking forward its fall. Along the Syrian-Israeli border now, you find mostly Islamist opposition groups that are in control of the border. The border crossing in Quneitra has been taken over by Jabhat al-Nusra, the al-Nusra Front, the Syrian al-Qaeda affiliate organization. So from Israel's perspective, Assad, on the one hand, may be good, but on the other hand, if, and I'm now thinking about not a completely improbable scenario, if Hezbollah helps Assad to retake the southern part of Syria along the Golan Heights, along the border with Israel, Israel might find itself facing Hezbollah not only with its border in Lebanon, but also in Syria. So going back to my earlier point about messiness, we are just, it's becoming messier by the day, maybe even by the moment. And if you listen to Prime Minister Netanyahu in recent days, in his visit now to the United States, he has tried to make some associations between the Islamic State and Hamas to try and portray a picture as if exactly as the United States is fighting and leading the coalition against the Islamic State, Israel is facing a similar threat. And that's, you know, another angle of this entanglement and an attempt by Israel to portray some symmetry or similarity between the United States and the Islamic State and Israel and Hamas, which I believe is completely false.
So when Prime Minister Netanyahu, in fact, he spoke at the White House in front of the President Obama, putting words in Obama's mouth, I noticed, and when he makes that claim that we're sort of brothers in arms, the U.S. and Israel, because we're fighting a similar enemy, and citing Hamas. Hamas, of course, was formed by the Muslim Brotherhood. The Turks support the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood were the original people, largely, who took to the streets to fight Assad. And prior to that, of course, in Hama, there was an uprising which was brutally put down by Assad's father, and up to 40,000 people were massacred. There's no question that the Muslim Brotherhood they're trying to pursue democratic methods of Islamic government, aren't they? They're not these crazy Islamist beheaders who want to return to the Sharia and go back to the 7th century.
Yeah, I cannot speak on behalf of all Muslim Brotherhood branches in the Middle East, but if you look at Hamas, which, as you said correctly, I mean, was born out of the Muslim Brotherhood branch in Gaza. Hamas is it's an Islamist organization, but it is first and foremost a national organization, and its agenda is very clearly circumscribed within the boundaries of Israel or Palestine, and it may wish to eliminate Israel, but still its ideology, its vision is pretty much based on Palestinian national aspirations. And one really would make a grave mistake by trying to make a connection between Hamas and the Islamic State. As you said yourself, it's a very rational organization, and it aspires to, you know, win the battle against Israel in a battle between two national movements fighting for the same piece of land. And this is how Hamas needs to be understood. The fact that it is also an Islamist organization doesn't reduce the fact that it is first and foremost a Palestinian one with a very, very, very clear national agenda.
Well, clearly the Muslim Brotherhood have just taken some pretty heavy hits in Egypt. They were outlawed even though they won the election, and a military coup took over, in many ways financed by the Saudi Arabians. The Saudi Arabians hate the idea of the Muslim Brotherhood because it challenges their kind of medieval monarchy It's a more democratic model, and for some reasons which I've never quite understood, Qatar, the emir, has always supported the Muslim Brotherhood, as has Erdogan in Turkey, who's a big champion. But now apparently the Gulf states, the Saudis and the U.S. have pressured Qatar to get rid of the Muslim Brotherhood leaders there. They've gone to Turkey. Is there any way that they can be revived politically? I mean, it's such a strange world now where, Israel and Saudi Arabia are on the same page in a way. And Israel, in Saudi Arabia, of course, has been encouraging the worst kind of reactionary Islam, political Islam, that has led to the Islamic State.
The Islamic State is a result of, state failure in Syria and Iraq to a large extent. And Saudi Arabia may have provided, I don't know if ideology, but definitely manpower.
And the seed money, I think you could say, right?
Yes. But if you look at the history of the Arab-Israeli conflict, you would see many times clear cooperation between Israel and Saudi Arabia. Both countries seek stability over anything else. And even at times when the Saudis were financing the Palestinian arms struggle against Israel, at the same time they were also very much in line with Israel over broader themes such as a general conservative view towards the Middle East, distrust of any revolutionary ideas, and an attempt to basically remain in power. And of course the alliance with the United States is crucial for both countries, for both countries' survival.
So what do you think then in the last couple of minutes, Asher Kaplan? My understanding is that you hear these rumors, but I think there's some fire where there's all this smoke, and that is that this deal with Iran may come off and it may change and help bury the hatchet on this long and painful relationship between the United States and Iran. Because you recall that the Shah was the U.S.'s guy in the Middle East until he fell. So it's possible that a major strategic shift could be underway. And given the relationship of Iran to Assad and Hezbollah, et cetera, there could be some major changes underway, even if nobody wants to take Graham Fuller's advice that they should make a deal with Assad.
Yeah, I mean, if indeed a deal is struck between Iran and the United States, that could also amend the fences, amend the relationship between the two countries, we could see a major strategic change, a dramatic change in the Middle East, and that actually could be possibly a way out of, or at least one constructive way to think about the Syrian civil war, if Iran actually agrees that Assad personally, the person, is the problem, and that in exchange for maintaining influence in Syria, Iran would be willing to give up Assad, the person himself. And that may be a scenario that we could think about, but we'll only be able to tell, days we'll only be able to tell about that in the future.
Sure, and meanwhile in Iraq, you've got the U.S. and Iran effectively working together, and the Sunnis are getting sold out once again, and they could probably help more than anybody to turn against the Islamic State since they're in their territory. But there's no way the U.S. wants to go near the idea of breaking up Iraq. I guess there's no way an Obama is going to have Iraq collapse on his watch. So just in closing, what's your thoughts about whether Iraq can stay together?
That's a big question. I mean, there is no doubt for me that there is some I would call it Iraqi fetishism in the United States. If you look at the history of the last 30, 40 years, almost every American president was engaged somehow with Iraq. And clearly, despite the fact that Barack Obama began his first term, with the idea that he's going to leave Iraq, he is clearly now returning to Iraq through this military campaign. The only way to deal with this mess that we are now witnessing is through rebuilding state capacities in Syria and in Iraq. And my hope is that this would be able to happen. It's a question of years now.
Sure.
Many years.
Well, it's a hope in the face of despair, and and there's no evidence to support it. But I thank you for joining us, Asher Kaufman.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Asher Kaufman, who's a professor of history and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame. Prior to that, he taught at Hebrew University, Jerusalem, and from 2000 to 2004 was a research fellow at the Harry S. Truman Research Institute for the Advancement of Peace and headed its Middle East unit. Kaufman is the author of Reviving Phoenicia, The Search for Identity in Lebanon, A History of Modern Lebanese National Identity, and his latest book is Contested Frontiers, Cartography, Sovereignty, and Conflict at the Syria-Lebanon-Israel Tri-Border Region.
جيتني بجوز عيونه هالاسمار الحنطاوي
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Thomas Edsel, who's a professor of journalism at Columbia University. His column on demographic and strategic trends in American politics appears every Wednesday. During the year leading up to the 2010 elections, he wrote for the New York Times as a weekly contributor to Campaign Stops. He covered American politics at the Washington Post from 1981 to 2006, and before that at the Baltimore Sun and the Providence Journal. He's the author of Power and Money, Writing About Politics, The New Politics of Inequality, and his latest book is The Age of Austerity. He has an op-ed at the New York Times, Are Liberals Funding Hypocrites? Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Edsel.
Good to be with you.
And I take it the double entendre there is not in the title, is not intended. The liberals are funding hypocrites. They're not funding hypocritical people, but they are funding hypocrites. Right.
That's a good question. No, that's not the argument.
Yes, exactly. So to give us your argument then.
There are a number of liberals in general complain bitterly about what are called dark money groups, which in fact are pretty much conservative and Republican. But the fact is that there are also some groups that do not disclose their donors or their activities or their supporters. And so the liberals basically do not have clean hands in this debate. The further part of my argument is that this is a kind of spending that liberals ought to really come out strongly against it for just purely political reasons, because it is overwhelmingly benefiting Republicans much more than Democrats. And if it were eliminated, the net gain would be on the left-hand side of the political spectrum.
But how do the Democrats do that without unilaterally disarming, given the advantage with dark money is on the Republican side?
That's a big problem, and I agree. Well, the fact is, actually, Democrats are doing quite well in the other area. It's also subject to criticism, but super PACs, and party fundraising, which both of which can be in more substantial and larger donations. On that front, in many cases, they are beating the Republicans. So it may be the problem is that the dark money is there and it's going to stay there as long as there is basically a level of bipartisan support. I think dark money corrupts the system in numerous ways. Most of all, the anonymity that it allows means that you have people financing elections and interests financing elections that the public has no idea of who they are. And pulling out of it is painful, but I think it actually the amount of gains that Democrats have from it are marginal and not that significant.
Well, an example you give in your article in the New York Times, "Are Liberals Funding Hypocrites?" is the North Carolina Senate race, which is a key race. Tom
yes.
Tillis, the Republican challenger, has so far spent $3.23 million, and conservative dark money, that's open money, if you will, conservative dark money groups have invested twice that, $6.7 million. And on the other side, Kay Hagan, the incumbent Democrat, has raised $7.96 million, almost $8 million, what's the opposite of dark money? Sunlight money or whatever.
They call it hard money.
Hard money, right.
Yeah.
And liberal dark money groups have spent only $2.1 million. So there's the comparison there. But when you talk about the filibuster changing the rules, I think when that happened, it didn't happen in a vacuum. It happened because the Democrats simply couldn't get anything passed. Now, at the time, I recall a lot of people warned that this could backfire because if the Republicans take the Senate, as many expect, in November, then they'll have this extraordinary advantage. So,
not really. They won't until 2016, and then only if they have the presidency.
I see.
These are votes on executive branch appointments, either to the different agencies or to judgeships. And if they win the Senate in 2014, they actually are going to have a hard time in 2016 holding it because those 2016 senators are much more, there are many more Republicans and there are a lot of vulnerable Republicans. So at any rate, there's a lot of ifs in that.
Right, but there's also I think it's pretty obvious, isn't it, Thomas Edsel, that if the Republicans win the Senate in November, Obama will not get any judicial appointments through. Zero, right? They're just not going to cooperate.
Yeah, that would be true with or without the the filibuster.
Right. So in terms of your critique, then, of the liberals being hypocrites, it's more that they, in trying to sort of catch up to this flow of dark money, which has largely favored the Republicans, and I think you have to go back to Citizens United decision, don't you, that allowed all this to happen, and that seems to clearly have favored Republicans, even though ostensibly the Supreme Court unshackled any limits on both corporate money and labor money, but there's always been an asymmetry there. I just talked to some people from CRU the other day, a group in Washington, who managed to get hold of documents from the Republican Governors Association that indicated an enormous amount of dark money was flowing from corporate heads to Republican governors in exchange for access. This was not meant to be publicized, but apparently they accidentally posted it online. But the thing that I always understood was that what regulated corporate money in politics was that the corporate heads themselves figured that half of our customers are Democrats and half of them are Republican, and we don't want to anger half of the constituency. So they sort of that sort of was self-regulating. But those days are over, are they not, because of Citizens United?
Well, in terms of their public contributions, they're still going to likely do some splitting. That depends on the industry. There's some heavily regulated industries like oil industry, the pharmaceutical industry, chemical industry. They have become, even before Citizens United, decisively Republican. There are other industries, Hollywood for one, Silicon Valley pretty much is another, where they tend to be strongly Democratic. But what Citizens United did was allow this dark money channel, which means that corporations no longer have to worry about the public relations aspect. Are they going to irritate their customers who are Democrats by putting $20 million into a Republican group? They won't, because it's dark money and it will not be disclosed. So in that sense, the Citizens United decision opened by allowing companies to make secret donations to 501c4 organizations that do political advertising but don't disclose their donors. That basically opened the door to much more partisanship.
So what then would you recommend that the Democrats do to level the playing field, apart from the fact that by joining in this corrupt process of dark money, they're in effect losing any moral standing they have? What is their alternative?
Well, let me just make one other point, that not only do they lose moral standing, but it means that both parties, if both sides do this and play this ball game, then both sides are basically being financed by very rich people. Some are liberal, some are conservative. The effect, though, is that when you get to other policies, like what should the capital gains tax rate be? Should hedge funds be allowed to treat the owners of hedge funds treat their income as capital gains and pay a much lower tax rate? You're going to have interests on both sides on that, basically an agreement that to protect the interests of those who have a lot of money on economic issues. And the result is going to be, as there has been no effort to basically take back the hedge fund tax break, which Obama has talked about, but so far has done nothing about. And so you have a policy program. So you're damaging the party in its ability to represent its own constituents. It does not damage the Republican Party to do this, because they are the party of more affluent people. And it's not a conflict on their part to be opposed to raising taxes on hedge funds. It's part of their ideological position to support lower taxes on hedge funds. But the Democratic Party has been put in a position of being ideologically adverse, in a sense, because of the moneyed interest behind it, adverse to the interests of its regular Joe and Jill six-pack constituents.
Well, that's been something of an ongoing trend, has it not, in many ways started by Bill Clinton to move to Wall Street. And Obama, I think, raised more money in 2008 from Wall Street than McCain did. This does raise a question here, which is that how does the Democratic Party represent working Americans and middle-class Americans when they get their money from the same people as the Republicans do? And that seems to me to be a debate that obviously the party doesn't want to have, but the people should have. And what's your sense if that were to happen? I know the Democrats do raise more money from small donors than the Republicans do, and MoveOn.org started that trend. Is it possible to come up with a more honest grassroots way to fund, or is it just these things are just so expensive that it can't be done?
I think that in 2008, Obama was raising so much money in small donations that he didn't really need to take all that money that he did from Wall Street. But politicians will never turn down money as a problem. I don't know whether it's a question of which comes first, the chicken or the egg. Does the money define what the party and its candidates do, or do the candidates get do something in order to raise money? And I think both take place. And breaking that cycle is a very difficult process. To be honest, I think the only way it would be broken is by a very successful, charismatic candidate running on a much more populist kind of agenda than has happened in recent years.
Well, just in closing, Lawrence Lessig he's decided if you can't beat him, join him. And he's set up these PACs that raise money for candidates who make a pledge to sign a constitutional amendment to get rid of Citizens United and to ban dark money and big money in politics. What do you think of that?
Well, it's an interesting idea. I don't know how many new people he has added to the list who are already prepared to vote against dark money. I would be interested to know whether, in fact, his effort is changing the dynamics of the debate by actually shifting votes. To be honest, he may be and he may not be. I just don't know. If he is, that's an interesting approach, and it does, in a sense, run counter to what I was saying, but I would like to see its effectiveness.
But just in closing, though, the system we have now, you know, the only people who could be dealing with it would be the IRS, and they've been neutered by this phony scandal over...
No, it's not just the IRS. One is the IRS. Two is the Federal Election Commission,
sure,
which has ducked it. The Federal Election Commission could stop this dark money stuff in a second, but the way it's structured, it doesn't. And the third is changing one vote on the Supreme Court would change the whole thing. There are three different pressure points at the, outside of Congress that could alter the whole debate.
Well, Thomas Edsel, I thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Edsel, who is a professor of journalism at Columbia University. His column on demographic and strategic trends in American politics appears every Wednesday online at the New York Times. And during the year leading up to the 2012 elections, he wrote for the New York Times as a weekly contributor to Campaign Stops. He covered American politics at the Washington Post from 1981 to 2006, and before that at the Baltimore Sun and the Providence Journal. He's the author of Power and Money, Writing About Politics, The New Politics of Inequality, and his latest book is The Age of Austerity. He has an op-ed at the New York Times, Are Liberals Funding Hypocrites? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.